This evening is Mr. Dave Snoblin, and his topic is Approaching the Frontiers of Faith.
You're leaving me up here all by myself. Well, thanks for coming out, everybody. I know there's a lot of things that we could be doing on a Sunday night, and it's nice of you to all come and gather together here, and we'll open the pages of the Bible and see what we can discover. I have to admit that this title is not original. It's kind of a modification of the opening line of the old science fiction show on television. You may have heard it. Space. The final frontier. And I don't know quite how that transpired, but sometime last summer I either read it or I heard it on the radio. I can't remember which. And it started percolating around in there. And I thought, well, I'm kind of lean that way anyway with things that I read, you know, science fiction. But started percolating around in there, and I thought, well, that space kind of sounds like faith. So you could have faith the final frontier. Well, that would be interesting. Well, at least I thought it would be interesting. And then I thought, well, you know, you could put other words in there. You know, faith the frontier. So I fiddled around with that for a while, and I thought I had a pretty good idea. So I've developed a number of little talks on the various words that I filled in the space with. And Brother Stephen was at kind of odds and ends trying to find speakers last December, and I said, I could do one. And he said, well, why not January the 6th? And I said, that sounds good to me. But it obviously didn't sound good to somebody, because January the 6th was not a good day for me. However, here we go. So tonight I plan to present a few ideas around this idea of approaching the frontiers of faith. And I hope that you find them interesting and instructive, and hope that we can sort of enjoy ourselves. Now, one of the things that will be required this evening is the use of your imagination. And not to imagine imaginary things, but actually to visualize real events. Because, you know, when we open the pages of Scripture and we start looking at examples and incidents there, we're not just reading two-dimensional or one-dimensional black and white words on the page. We're reading about real events, and they happen to real people in real time, and all the things that, you know, go on in a human being's life all around them. It isn't ever just sort of one-dimensional. So you may have to use somewhat of your imagination to think about those things. Now, there's two key words in the title, obviously, faith and frontiers. And just so that we're all more or less on the same three-dimensional page, the best definition of faith, of any kind of faith that you want to talk about, but in, of course, this case it's the biblical faith, is Hebrews 11, the first couple of verses there, that tell us that faith gives substance to our hope, and provides us with evidence for things that we can't see, right? So you can work that around in your mind as much as you want, but it's a really good, solid definition of what faith is, right? So that's what I'm considering when I talk about faith, that kind of a definition that we get from Hebrews 11. And then frontiers. Well, a frontier, you know, there's certain of us, I suppose, that are getting on, or however old you like to. But when somebody says frontier, we immediately think back to the pictures that we had of the covered wagons in the Old West, you know, going out to the frontier. Well, that's kind of just one. In other words, the frontier can be the edge of habitation in a given land, right? Frontier can be the borders between two countries. Frontier can be the limits of our knowledge or ability in a certain field, right? So you quite often hear about, you know, pushing the frontiers of science or pushing the frontiers of medicine or any number of those kind of things. Sporting endeavors, you know, you can hear the edge of the performance is the frontier. And so I think that's how I view this idea of a frontier of faith. It's the edge, it's the limit. It's as far as you've ever been or as far as you think you can go, right? And so that's the kind of the idea that we're going to approach tonight. And, of course, we all know that the Bible presents us with numerous examples and accounts of this kind of thing. People who have been brought to, against their will, so to speak, or who approach purposely the frontier of their faith, the limits, the borders of the things that they believe. Now, the Bible was written over a long time by a lot of different authors, and so we find that the situations and the experiences vary. You know, we have, maybe 1,000 years between some of these incidents, and we have people who were kings, we have people who were shepherds, and we have women of Gentile descent, and we have women of Israel descent, 1,000 years apart. So all these experiences vary, and the results are somewhat different. But every time we look into this and we think about it, there are lessons that are learned, and there are truths that are exposed. So tonight, I've picked three, and I hope I can get through them, without too many of you leaving or whatever. But I've picked three different things, and they're well known to you. So we're going to rehearse some of the things that you already know. And I'm hoping that during the process, if I look up and I see that you're kind of looking down with your eyes closed, that what you're really doing is imagining the situation that I'm describing and thinking about it in three-dimensional terms. So I'm going to give you that much credit anyway. Now, what I want to do is start in the book of Ruth. And this one I call Faith the Foundation Frontier. That's Faith the Foundation Frontier. Now, the thing about the book of Ruth, and it can be said of a lot of the books in the Bible, obviously, but the thing that I'm constantly amazed by in the book of Ruth is just how much information there's packed into less than 100 verses. Now, I know that over the years, many of us have heard talks on the book of Ruth, we've read books on the book of Ruth, we've, considered it in many ways, and we get into the meat of it, and we're discussing at great length various aspects. It's only 100 verses. It's a small, it's a tiny little, it's almost just an essay, really, But there's a lot there. There's insights into Jewish life of the times. There's character studies. There's insight into Old Testament law. And, of course, there's this allegory that comes out of the overall plan of salvation, and on and on we go. So as we're reading through the book of Ruth, there's five characters that we find that are brought to the frontiers of their faith. They're brought right to the borders, the limits of the things that they understand and believe in. Now, two of them I'll just deal with right away. Come to this frontier and turn away, right? And that's Orpah. And the kinsman, the near kinsman, right? Not given his name. But both of them are brought to the frontier, brought to the edge, and they turn away from that and go back where they were or refuse to make the next step. So those are two of the five that are brought to the edge of their faith. The other three, of course, are Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. And there are a good many things to think about when we consider each individual one. So Naomi, because we're looking back and we know, we can read chapter 4 first if we want to, we can pretty surely say that Naomi was a faithful woman. Naomi was a woman who had a good, solid knowledge of the law. She had a heritage in Israel and a pretty strong faith. So we can say that about Naomi looking back. But if, as we read from chapter 1 on, of course, we read through Naomi's experiences in this probably 10 to 15 year period of her life. Chapter 1 tells us they were about 10 years in Moab, and it doesn't tell us sort of how long just before that and how long after that. So I'm going to say somewhere between 10 and 15 years of her life. And she, in this 10 to 15 year period, she approaches the frontier of her faith. I'm going to use this term a lot tonight. So she approaches the frontier. She's brought to the edges of her faith. And it's not an approach that comes, you know, sort of like Orpah's, bang, and there it is, and you've got to make your decision. It comes over a period of time. Now, consider this faithful woman. Her and her family leave their inheritance, their home, and go to Moab. Now, you know, we could quickly judge that and say, well, that's the wrong thing to do. But when you read the first verse of chapter 1 of Ruth, you find out it was during the time of the judges and they left under a famine. Now, those of us that know the scripture know that in the time of the judges, when there was a famine, it was usually a bad judge, and things weren't going very well for Israel. So I think that this family probably agonized quite a bit over what to do. And it may be they made a mistake, but it was a serious time in the nation of Israel, and they looked at Moab across the border, and they said, well, you know, this is not good here. The judge is corrupt, and things are being done that aren't against the law. So we're going to leave. Well, so this is a first thing in the life of Naomi, which was wrenching, you know. And she made this decision with her husband, and they left. Now, over the next few years, her life goes downwards. There's a downward spiral. I don't know whether the sons married the Moabitish girls before her husband died or whether after. And I may be not reading properly, but in any case, they married Moabite girls. Now, that wasn't something that a faithful Israelitish woman would have liked. Her husband dies. Then her sons die. Now, here she is, a woman in a foreign land with no breadwinners left in the family and two daughter-in-laws who were Moabites. So you can see that the life has spiraled down pretty far. And she's in abject poverty at this point. She's got no inheritance there and nobody to provide and no residual income to live on. She looks, to her credit, she looks back to Israel. And you can find in Deuteronomy 30 something about in the law that if things were bad and the Israelites were driven out and they looked back to the land and awakened their faith and God would bring them back. That's in Deuteronomy 30. And that's also in Solomon's Prayer, which I realize was after this. But that's a pattern. She looks back to the nation of Israel and decides to return. Now, she can't return in great confidence because she left and there's people there who remember that she left and she's not too proud of what she's done and she's broke. And she's got to do something about her daughter-in-law, right? So that you can see she's really sunk down. But now, in the book of Ruth, we also find that at a certain point in time, Naomi, in her situation, is awakened. Her mind, her faith, her knowledge that was way back in the back of her mind is awakened, and she remembers something about the law, something about there being some hope. And she proceeds to follow that up. So that's Naomi being brought, I have to say reluctantly, but being brought to a frontier, right? Being brought to the limits of her faith and having to make a decision and having to make what she was going to do. Ruth, a Moabitish girl, meets and marries this young Israelite. And I don't know that there was a whole lot of interest on her part of her family either for her marrying an Israelite rather than a good Moabitish boy who lived next door. You know, I don't know. But that was something that she did, which was probably less than popular. And, of course, following along with Naomi, not too long after, she loses her husband and she sinks into poverty with Naomi. And there are a couple of things that happen in Ruth's life as a result of this. For instance, she doesn't immediately run home to her parents. She stays with Naomi. That's you know, part of the story of Ruth. When it comes time to leave Moab, you know, we know in Ruth chapter 1, the famous speech that she makes, she decides to go with Naomi. When she gets to Israel, she is not too proud to do what she has to do, to go to gleaning, which was, you know, bottom of the barrel. She meets Boaz. She hears Naomi's plan when Naomi's faith is awakened, and she follows along with it. So in this case, this is Ruth coming to her frontier. You know, we don't know what her history of her beliefs were before, but we know that she leaves them, she throws them over, and she converts to the Israelitish faith and goes with Naomi. The conversion comes in, conversion is recorded in the first chapter, verse 16. And Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave thee, to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. Step one, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Step two, and thy people shall be my people. Step three, and thy God, my God. Step four, where thou diest, will I die. Step five, and I will be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." This is like a 5 or 6 step conversion, right? An admission of where she wants to go, who she believes in, and where she is going to reside. So that's Ruth coming to her frontier and crossing it. Now, Boaz, when I did a study of the book, I don't know why the book wasn't called Boaz, actually. He is, maybe it was just that I was ignorant, but he is the most remarkable person. And I don't know that there's time to really go through it all. But what I find amazing about Boaz is his awareness, his understanding, his preparation, his integrity, and his willingness to do what had to be done. And you know, you have to give yourself some time to think about. Now, where did that come from? We find out that he's a very wealthy man. And my question when I looked at this first was, did Boaz know his responsibility as a kinsman and work like a dog to become wealthy so he could do it? Or did he work really hard and become wealthy and then somebody point out to him his responsibility as a near kinsman? I don't know. But there's no doubt, as you read through the account of Boaz, that he knew his responsibility. He, I believe, had done research on his family and knew the situation about his family. He certainly was a fantastic judge of character as he looked at Ruth and understood who she was and what she was about and what she was doing. He was aware of the situation, right? In other words, it wasn't like the situation went by him and he said, "Oh, I should have done this." He was right on top of it the whole time. And he was prepared in the integrity of his being to do what he had to do, as we learn as we read chapters 3 and 4. But nevertheless, in all of that, he was brought to a frontier of his faith, because here was a man of great standing in the community who had a tremendously difficult decision to make. He was prepared to do his part as a near kinsman, but he had to really stick his neck out a mile, and the other kinsman wasn't prepared to do that. In chapter 4, verse 5, then said Boaz, "What day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must also buy it of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance." And the near kinsman said, "I can't do this because I'll ruin my own inheritance." So Boaz, you know, came to that same frontier as the other near kinsman. But Boaz, in his integrity and in his understanding and his knowledge, was able to cross that frontier. So each one of these people was faced with a very real test of their faith in real time. And each one of them, as we go through it, each one of them went across that frontier. And I forgot to go into the details of Naomi as she got there, but it's chapter 2 and verse 20, because Ruth comes home and says, "Oh, I was working today in the field of Boaz." Now, up to this point, Naomi's been sad and depressed, right? She comes home and says, "I've been working in the field of Boaz." And verse 20, verse 20, Naomi said unto her, "The man is nigh of kin unto us, one of our near kinsmen." Right? And Naomi said in verse 22 unto Ruth, her daughter, "Or not, is good, my daughter, that thou go out with his maidens, and they meet thee not in another field." All right? And then in chapter 3, we find out that Naomi proceeds under the provisions of the law to try and get rest and try and restore the inheritance of the family. So it's just amazing. She's sad, and then when she finds out it's Boaz, she goes, "Oh, this is Boaz. He's a near kinsman. Ah, it's all coming back to me now." And away she goes. And so here we have these encounters with these three people at the frontiers of their faith in real life situations. Also, some foundations of faith. We have an allegory here because Naomi is allegorical of Israel, right? And we know from the Prayer of Solomon or from the book of Deuteronomy or many, many other places, how many times Israel went off track. And they were off track and they were in a bad situation and they looked back. Right? Daniel did it in one of his prayers. We were wrong. We sinned. You know, we deserved this, but what can you do? And they repented and back they came. And this is allegorical of Israel. Also allegorical is the fact that Naomi was a tremendous example to these two Gentile women, right? And Orpah, I realize Orpah didn't make the step, but Ruth did. And she must have done it because of the example that Naomi set her of faith and the things that Naomi told her about the God of Israel. Ruth, of course, is allegorical of the Gentiles, looking to Israel and seeing the salvation that's there. Right, recognizing the value and the blessings that are there coming from Israel as the root of faith. And Boaz, of course, is allegorical of the Redeemer in so many ways, an absolute positive living example of what a Redeemer would be like. You know, lifelong preparation and knowledge of the situation and step-by-step positive action to do that. It's just a tremendous example of these people being brought to the frontiers of their faith, and there's the foundations laid. Faith, the foundation frontier. Now, we had read 1 Kings chapter 17, a couple of verses out of that. And this is another frontier we're going to approach, and I call it faith, the fantastic frontier. Now, we've got some major players here. Obviously, there's Elijah the Tishbite, Ahab the king, and I'll say the nation of Israel. There's some other ones, too, which we'll get into in a couple of minutes. But we're told in another place in Scripture that Elijah was a man of like passions such as we are. And as we read through the account of Elijah here in 1 Kings, we find out that's true. He was a tremendous prophet. He'd done a lot of things. And in fact, in this case, as we read tonight, he had predicted this drought. So he was a tremendous prophet. He was, in fact, according to the law, he was a real prophet because the things that he had said, spoken on behalf of God, had come true. And that was the test, right? So he was a tremendous prophet. But he was a man of like passions. And despite the fact that he was this prophet with and had done these things, he was still living in fear. He had predicted these things, and then the king and queen, Ahab and Jezebel, didn't like him. So he was aware that they were out looking for him. So he was hiding out, right? He was under a lot of pressure to say what he had to say and then to try and stay out of the way of these two nasty folks. So Elijah was a like man, such as we are, like passions. Now Ahab, the king, was not a good guy, right? That goes without saying. He was greedy. He was impatient. He wasn't hesitant to take whatever he wanted. He didn't have any use for the God that Elijah had talked about. He was used to having his own way. All of the above, but he was under a lot of pressure too. Because it hadn't rained for 3 years. Now, you know, a couple of months or 6 months or so of no rain, well, you can get by with that, right? But after 3 years, well, he sends Obadiah out looking for pasture for the horses. He was in danger of losing his stables. But probably a little more than that, the people, the nation was probably getting a little bit antsy with him too, because after all, Ahab, you're the king, and we haven't had any rain for 3 years, and if we don't get some rain soon, it's all over. So I can see that Ahab was under a lot of pressure to make things happen. You could throw the prophets of Baal in here too, if you like, because you know they were happy to be the prophets of Baal and have an elevated position in society, but they hadn't been able to do anything about the no rain either. So you can imagine that they were under a bit of pressure to perform. Now the nation of Israel, that is the northern kingdom here, I think they were feeling the pressure too. We're told in these chapters here that they were limping between two sides. They were indecisive. And I think the pressure was doing that to them. In other words, before the drought, before Elijah had said it's not going to rain, they were happy to go along with the prophets of Baal and follow that religious line because it was very appealing to the senses, appealing to the flesh, if you would. And they were happy to go along with it, and everything seemed to be fine. But now after 3 years and things weren't happening, you know, they were under some pressure to make a decision here, because was it Baal, the god of the land, that they were going to follow, or was it the Lord who brought them out of Egypt who had been keeping the rain from them for 3 years that they were going to follow? So there's, you know, picturing this in three, you can see that the political situation and the social situation in the nation at this point must have been a real pressure cooker. There was a lot going on. And so, you know, when it comes in chapter 18, God says to Elijah, well, okay, it's time. Go and show yourself to Ahab. And then Elijah shows up, and there's Obadiah looking around for water. And he's, hey, Obadiah, how's it going? I'm come to see Ahab. You know, and Obadiah goes, well, wait a minute. Ahab's been looking for you for 3 years, you know, and we can't find you, and now you want me to go and talk to Ahab? I'm a little worried about this. So, you know, even Obadiah was a little on edge, and he was a pretty faithful guy. So there's a lot going on. Now, about the word fantastic, which I've got in this title. When we say fantastic nowadays, we usually mean something, you know, we've had a fantastic holiday or a fantastic meal or the neighbor just bought a fantastic car or something. You know, it's something that's positive and we like it and it's really good. But there's another side to the word. You know, when you look up the history of the word, as it were, it comes from the word phantasm. And phantasm has kind of a dark side. And it has a connotation of meaning something that's outside our experience, something we can't explain, something beyond our ability to comprehend, right? So there's that side of fantastic as well. So back to the situation. Here we go. 3 years, no rain. Elijah's hiding out. There's no crops. There's no water for the horses. The nation's indecisive, and something is about to happen. So Elijah eventually gets to meet Ahab in chapter 18, verse 17, we find the record of that. And Ahab sees Elijah, and he says, so here you are, right, you troublemaker. And, of course, Elijah gives him the answer. It's not me, it's you. The reason you're in trouble here is it's you. You've forsaken all the law. You've forsaken everything that's right, the commandments of the Lord, and now you've followed Baal, and that's why the trouble. So there's a confrontation, and a decision is made, right? And the decision is, okay, here's what's going to happen. We've got to sort this problem out, and here's what I suggest. We'll all meet on Mount Carmel, and we'll have it out. Now, it's interesting that what Elijah calls for. He says, gather to me all Israel, okay? And that's a phrase that you could think about. But gather to me all Israel and the prophets of Baal, 450, and the prophets of the Asherah, 400, that eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent and gathered all Israel and all the prophets. It doesn't say that, but I'm assuming they gathered all the prophets up to the mountain. So that's something to imagine, isn't it? You can close your eyes now and imagine that if you want. But evidently Mount Carmel is a big plain up on the top there, and you can see out over the Mediterranean. And there's a crowd gathering. I think, well, if you had the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 of the Asherah, and then you've got Ahab's group, you know, his court, you could easily right there have 1,000 people. And then all Israel. So what does that mean? Was there 3,000? Was there 5,000? Was there 10,000 people up there? I don't know. But I could really confident that it was a big crowd. So that's, you know, remember that. This is a big crowd gathered up on the top of this mountain. And Elijah gives his speech, you know, how long are you going to go limping between two sides? How long are you going to be indecisive about this stuff? So if the Lord is God, follow him. And if Baal, follow him. And the crowd is, you know, they're not there yet. They're not with him. They're kind of, okay, that's fine you said that, but we're not, you know, we're not going to make any decisions. So then Elijah sticks his neck out a little. And he says, look, I'm the only prophet left of the Lord, but there's 450 prophets of Baal there. So here's what you should do. We'll set up two altars, and then we'll see which god can burn the altar, can light the altar. And even one more than that, they can go first. Well, then everybody's happy. Well, great, you know, because, you know, if it's a god, if each one's a god, and they're both capable of lighting the altar, and you let the prophets of Baal go first, well, then we're good, right? So they're happy. And they said, it is well spoken. So, you know, we know the story. They get it ready. Now, this is another thing that I think that we need to stop, and instead of just reading the two black and white words there, we need to think about it. You've got at least 450 people preparing this altar. And in my imagination, I don't think they were conservative dressers. I don't think they were, you know, quiet people. But in any case, they make the altar, and they get ready, and they start. Right? And it says they started in the morning, from the morning till noon, calling out to Baal. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. I'm going to say, you know, they set the altar up, and they had some procedures and some things that they did, and they started out in a fairly orderly fashion, going around the altar, saying they're chanting their chants, and playing their music and doing whatever they had to do, and nothing happened. So about noon, Elijah gives them a little mocking. He challenges them. And, you know, well, look, maybe you've got to shout louder. Maybe he's on a journey or what, you know, gives them a number of reasons. And by now they're starting to get a little edgy because they've been going at it for 3 or 4 hours. I'm not sure how long, and nothing's happening. So, okay, maybe we better. And so from this point on, the whole thing loses all sense of propriety and decorum. And these people start dancing and yelling and wailing and playing music and around the altar and leap and cutting themselves, right? So after an hour or two, my imagination tells me that in a place that there'd been no rain for 3 years and 450 people dancing and yelling and screaming around, there was a great cloud of dust. There was noise that you couldn't get close to. There was blood and there was dirt. It must have been absolute chaos up there. And still nothing happened. And so this whole performance that reached a great crescendo of noise and action slowly started to die away. And gradually one or two would get tired and just run out of energy and drop to the side, and three or four more, and five or six more. And pretty soon, by the time of the evening oblation, there may have been one or two left that were just kind of wandering around in the daze, and even they sat down and there was no noise anymore at all. Dead silence, nothing had happened. So then, Elijah, in verse 30 of chapter 18, Elijah said unto the people, come near unto me. It doesn't say there Elijah cried out with his megaphone, you know, or made a big scene. He just said. So now all the people could hear, just Elijah, and they could come near. They couldn't come near before because so much was going on. They were in fear for their lives, and they didn't want to get involved in all that chaos. So now they could come near. So they came near. And Elijah set about building the altar in the way it should be built. You know, in 12 stones, no tools, number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, etc., sets up this altar. He's got it all set up. He's got the wood, he's got the bullock, he's got the stones, everything set up properly. And then he puts 12 jars of water on it. I don't know how big the jars were, but he puts 12 jars of water on it. And then, after that, he fills the trench that he dug around it with water. So now we've got a soaking wet altar with a moat. I think one thing we have to give the prophets of Baal credit for was that in all that chaos, nobody sneaked in with a stick and lit the thing on fire. Right? They at least stuck to the rules of the challenge and didn't light it. But now, on this situation, even if somebody had wanted to sneak in and light it on fire, they couldn't do it because the thing was soaking wet and there was a ditch full of water around it. So then again, Elijah the prophet came near and said, once again, no leaping over the altar and cutting yourself with a knife or shouting or wailing or, you know, cymbals or noise or anything like that. He just merely came near to the altar and he said, O Lord, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, and that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word. Hear me, O Lord, hear me, that this people may know that thou art the Lord, that thou the Lord art God, and that thou hast turned their heart back again. It's pretty simple. Not 6 or 8 hours of dancing and dust and blood. Quietly. And I'm sure that all the people had got close enough that they could hear that. Now, what happens next is, I've often thought, well, for years I thought, okay, so the fire of the Lord fell, right? And we know what it did. So I've thought about, well, a great big blue-white thing came and zorched the altar and it was gone. But then I thought, well, that's not right, right? Because Because it would be, if you've got 5,000 or 6,000 people and it happened like that, it wouldn't register. They would see it was gone, but it wouldn't register. But then you read, and it's written here for a reason, right? It's written here. The fire of the Lord fell and consumed, 1, the burnt offering, 2, the wood, 3, the stones, 4, the dust, 5, licked up all the water that was in the trench. So however this long this took, it happened in a fashion that was just right for everybody to see, right? The sacrifice burned, the wood burned, the stones burned, the dust burned, and the water evaporate. So that in the end, all that was left was the bare ground with a trench. There wasn't even any dust there. No wonder they cried, Elijah, Elijah, right? The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God. Because what they'd seen was absolutely fantastic. I mean, the whole scene from the morning until now was fantastic in a way, right? Because all these guys dancing around in their clothes and their noise and their blood and their dust, that was fantastic in the negative sense. This was fantastic in the positive sense, right? The faith of this group of people was brought right to this frontier, and in the one fantastic demonstration of the power and the ability and the reality of their God, they saw the difference between the impotency of Baal and the power of their God in one fantastic revelation. It's amazing. So far we've looked at a couple of different situations, two different kinds of frontiers, and as I said at the start, there's all different ones through the Bible. I thought maybe there's one you could call faith the fearsome frontier, you know, or the fearful frontier. In other words, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Ananias and Sapphira, fear came on all the people. So you could do faith the fearsome frontier, or you could do faith the faulty frontier, you know, for instance, with Saul and his great blessing that he was given the kingship of Israel, but the fact that he was faulty and couldn't follow through on it. You know, over the years, various people experience these frontiers, and we're no different. We all face frontiers. Sometimes we call them trials, I suppose, but I like the frontier aspect of it. We're brought to the limits, to the edges of our faith, and we don't all face the same ones, right? We don't all face them at the same time. There is one, though, that we all share. And we could call that faith the final frontier. And I'd like to talk about it just for a few minutes because it's a really difficult one to talk about for a number of reasons. I suppose today we've had some in the past week or so, and today particularly, we've had some reminders of why it's kind of difficult to talk about. It's difficult to talk about, too, because some of us are a long way away from it, we think, right? And probably true. If we're somewhere between 16 and 30, we're a long way away from that frontier. On the other hand, if we're somewhere between 60 and 82, we're probably pretty close to it. And in both cases, it's difficult to talk about. On the one hand, because we can't really envision it. On the other hand, because we can envision it too clearly, right? But the question then, I suppose we could ask is, can faith survive an encounter with the final frontier? I think the question is probably best addressed by considering the most faithful person of all, and that's Jesus. And again, as it says at the end of the book of Luke, if all the things about Jesus were written in a book, we wouldn't have a book big enough, right? So obviously tonight we can't go into real depth on that. But one thing about Jesus was he was really focused, right? We know that Jesus was really focused from the time he was approximately 12 years old. He was in the temple. There was a great hue and cry because after a couple of days, his parents missed him. They didn't know where he was. They assumed he was with everybody else, but he wasn't, so they went back. And what did he say? Didn't you know I should be here talking, you know, about my father's business? This is what my life is about. Pretty fine focus for a 12-year-old. Pretty fine focus for any of us, but for a 12-year-old, wow. He goes to the time of his baptism, and John sees him coming. He says, wait a minute, I know who you are. You're the Lamb. I've got to be baptized of you. And Jesus said, no, you've got to do this. We've got to do this because, you know, this is the way it has to be. Suffer it to be so now. Again, tremendous focus, right? This is the way it has to be. In the wilderness, when he was tempted with all different aspects of you know, the things that we're all tempted with, the answer was always, you've got to worship and serve God. That's the only thing there is. Worship and serve God. Whatever you're offering me, that's not relevant. I've got to worship and serve God. So there again, the focus, right directly on where he was going and what he should be doing. And with that focus, of course, was this tremendous awareness of just who he was and what was happening and what needed to happen. He was aware of that all the time. And it's no more true than as he approached this final frontier, right? And he made every effort to point out to those that were around him what was going to happen. And that's a lengthy study, but there's just a couple of things I'd like to point out. Mark chapters 9 and 10, there's a couple of them. Mark chapter 9, verse 31. It says, for he taught his disciples and said unto them, the Son of Man is delivered up into the hands of men, and they shall kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he shall rise again. And then if you go over to chapter 10, verse 33, and he said, behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be delivered unto the chief priests, the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and they shall deliver him to the Gentiles, and they shall mock him, and shall spit upon him, and shall scourge him, and shall kill him, and after 3 days he shall rise again. So Jesus was well aware of the situation. When you close your eyes and visualize it based on the things you know from Scripture, it's absolutely phenomenal just how aware he was. Like, he was aware down to the day. He was aware down to the people involved. If you go back to Matthew 26 and the other Gospels as well, he was aware down to who was going to betray him. It was Judas, somebody that he'd been with for 3 years. He was aware of the situation down to the priests, the scribes, the Gentiles. They're going to mock me, they're going to spit on me, they're going to scourge me. He was aware down to the details of what was going to happen hour by hour as the thing drew near. He was completely aware of the details of his impending encounter with the final frontier. Now, you know, some people say, I've heard people say sometimes, that, you know, if we just knew things, you know, the more we know, you know, the easier it makes things. Because if you know stuff, then you can deal with it, right? I don't know that that's always true. Jesus knew all this, but it didn't make it easy for him. Look at Luke 22 and verse 42 we start with. You know, he's right into it now. This is the hour, right? And he's praying in the garden. And he's saying, you know, if you be willing, remove this cup. But nevertheless, not my will, but thine. And in verse 44, and be in agony, he prayed earnestly, and his sweat became, as it were, great drops of blood falling on the ground. The anxiety and the pressure of the situation even though he knew what he knew, even though he was the most faithful man before or since, did not take away the stress or the anxiety of this impending encounter with the final frontier, to the point where he broke out in a tremendously heavy sweat. And of course, we know from all of our reading, we know about the end, right? The details, how it went. He was, in fact, taken to the priests. He was, in fact, delivered to the Gentiles. He was, in fact, beaten and scourged, right? He was, in fact, nailed to the cross. And he had a tremendously painful and difficult encounter with the final frontier. And that was just the physical part of it. I can't, to imagine the mental part of it, knowing what he knew and believing what he believed, how it was so tremendously difficult to have to endure it. Can faith survive the final frontier? When the women came, and we find recorded in Matthew 28, when the women came to his tomb afterwards, the angel says, "Fear not ye, for I know that ye seek Jesus who hath been crucified. He is not here. He is risen, even as he said. Come see the place where the Lord lay. And go quickly and tell his disciples he is risen from the dead, and lo, he goeth before you into Galilee. There shall ye see him. Lo, I have told you." Right? So, the hints that he gave earlier on in what we read from Luke was that after 3 days, and when the women went there, he wasn't there, and the angels told them that he was in fact raised. I think we'll just close off by going to 2 Timothy. We've spent a short time considering some frontiers, some encounters of various frontiers as people are brought to the limits of their faith, as God brings them there, and by their experiences they learn lessons for themselves, and they provide lessons for us as the scriptures are example to us. And we've considered that for a few moments. We've considered the fact that this faithful man encountered the final frontier, the day of his death, and despite his faith, despite his knowledge, was every bit as difficult as we find it, and that the angels informed the women that he was in fact raised and that he was waiting for them in Galilee. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, we find an assurance from the great apostle Paul about what is possible for those, I was going to say for those of us, but we're all going to face it, as we all face that final frontier. And he says, "For I am already being offered, and the time of my departure is come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. Henceforth there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, shall give to me at that day, and not to me only, but also to all them that have loved his appearing."